This is Scan, and I'm Hal Dragset. Robert Veninga.
I think all of us have years that are very good years, in which everything seems to click for us. You know, you might get a raise, you might get a promotion, you might fall in love, whatever it may happen to be. And I think there are years which aren't too good for us. And it was a year that we had some health problems in my family, and it was also a year that I lost a very dear and close friend. He was an individual whom I had written a book with. He was a person whom I had done some research with. Our families vacationed together up in the woods in northwest Wisconsin, and he was my mentor, and he was my friend, and he died. And in the weeks following his death, I really struggled with trying to get my balance again and trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life, because we had so many plans together. And it was a very, very difficult experience for me to go through. Both my parents are living. I have never experienced death close up. I mean, I've gone to funerals and what have you. But nobody close to me has ever died. And my friend Jim Spradley was like an older brother to me. We did things together. He was my mentor in a way. We wrote a book together, and our families were very close. We would get together, I would say a minimum of 3 times every week, sometimes 4 for breakfast or lunch. And we'd talk about our dreams, and after we had written a book together, we were talking about another book and another research project. And I guess I would say there was nothing that I wouldn't confide with him. And that's very rare, because particularly for men, we don't generally have those close friends. And I never had a close friend as dear as he was in my whole life. And so when this friendship grew and it was cemented both by work and our families vacationing together, I was really unprepared for his illness. And he was ill for a total of 15 months. And he taught me a lot, not so much about death, but he taught me a lot about living when there was indeed the possibility that you were going to die. And so when I went to visit him, the thing that impressed me was that while the diagnosis was not very good, he was determined that he wanted to live every single day of his life, no matter how long or how short that may happen to be. And I remember one day when coming to him, and I came into his room, and he was sitting in the chair, and there was a flood of sunshine in his room, and he was sitting right in the middle of the sunshine, and he had beautiful music playing in the background. And as I came in, he said to me, "Isn't this a wonderful day?" And it both made me so terribly excited to see and happy to see how he was coping with his situation. And at the same time, it just depressed me very much to think that life could be that way. And yet in that situation, he was very optimistic. And he often said to me, he said, "We used to talk about going back up to northwest Wisconsin, up to our favorite lake together." And he said, you know, what he had learned by being there is that where you are is where your mind is. And he said he could vacation as much in that hospital room as he could up in northwest Wisconsin. And so he was a mentor, but he was an older brother to me. And I started to understand not just about death, I understood from him about life and how it's possible to be in a cancer facility and yet still live life to the fullest. And then he died. And that was when I really started to go through some very difficult experiences. One difficult experience was right when I was lecturing to my students at the University of Minnesota. And this occurred shortly after his death. And finally, I just broke down in front of the class. And I said to the class, "I got to tell you what's happened." And I was pretty broken up in front of the class. And one of the students came up to me and said, "Well, Dr. Veninga, you're going to get over this." And I remember feeling anger when he said that. And I thought to myself, you know, what does he know about this? And I discovered later that he had lost his wife in a car accident. And he knew a lot about grief. And so I sat down with him, and he became my teacher. And even though he was quite a bit younger than me, he started to teach me. And he said, "Look," he says, "the worst days are ahead of you. But," he says, "if I can tell you one thing, you are going to get through this." And so I talked to him for quite some time, and indeed he was my teacher. And And then in the weeks that followed, I started talking with psychologists, and I started talking with clergy men and women. And I started to understand grief in ways that I never understood before. Now, my office is right in the University of Minnesota's hospital, okay? And so I'm surrounded every day of my work life with people who are being wheeled to surgery and people who are very sick. But, you know, it takes an experience like this to understand life in a much deeper way. At least it did for me. And so one day I decided I was just going to walk around the hospital. And I remember seeing a young man who was just about to go through the green doors into the surgery suite. And he was crying softly. And I thought to myself, and his parents were there too. And the surgeon came out and put his arm around the boy. And then I walked over to the neonatal unit, and there was the parents there, and they were wondering whether a child was going to live. And it was out of this that the burning question came into my consciousness, and that is, how do we survive life's injustice? I mean, how am I going to survive this? And how am I going to get along for the rest of my days without a friend that is like an older brother? It's very true that you can't get through life without setbacks. Every year, 2 million people in the United States are divorced. 800,000 people have open heart surgery every year. Almost 1 million people will be diagnosed with cancer. And we have other kinds of upsets, so to speak. You know, we're driving down the road and we get hit by a drunk driver, and we know that life all of a sudden is very much changed. And so the question really is, how can we survive our tragedies? How can we take something which is so bleak and so difficult and in a way so ugly, and how can we turn that around so it's going to be a positive force in our lives?
You're listening to Scan. Robert and Jim were close friends when Jim suddenly died. Robert wondered how other people survive such gut-wrenching experiences. He pursued that question.
Well, in the months following my friend Jim Spradley's death, I decided that what I needed to do was to talk with other people who had experienced loss. And so I interviewed 115 individuals, all of whom were going through some of life's most wrenching experiences. And I found that there were many who did not survive their tragedies and who really were living their lives out feeling very depressed about life, very discouraged. But I found the overwhelming majority of the 115 that I interviewed that several years later, they in fact had survived. And so what I really wanted to try to do was to find out, why is it that some people survive and other people don't survive? And there are a number of things that go into survivors. And the very first thing that I learned was that the people who go through a gut-wrenching experience, those that survive, by and large have a good friend. They have somebody that sticks with them through the darkest hours that they go through. Academics call this the support system. I prefer just simply to say they've got a good friend that's with them. The poet Gil Brown once made the comment. He said, in life we forget the people that we laugh with, but we tend never to forget the people that we've cried with. And I think he was getting at a very fundamental truth, that when you have somebody that is there with you when you lose a child or you get a divorce or you lose your job, and they're with you and they stick to you and let you know that they believe in you, you really have a great gift. And so one of the characteristics of the survivors was that they had a friend, somebody who really did believe in them. Sometimes people will say to me, look, I'm going through some pretty tough times right now. What do you suggest? And I usually say the starting point is to find somebody that you can go out to breakfast with a couple mornings every week. Somebody you can call up at the end of the day, no matter what the hour is, and say, boy, I'm really feeling blue. But I think it's very important who you select as your best friend during this experience. I think you want somebody who really knows how to listen. Not only with their head, but somebody who knows how to listen with their heart. Somebody who can just listen to you talk. But I also think you need somebody who is upbeat and is personable and somebody who's going to say, I believe in you. The other day I happened to meet an individual who went through open heart surgery. And I said, how did you survive it? And he said, it was a very difficult experience. And he said, what made it so difficult was the night before my surgery. And, you know, that's a very tough surgery to go through. You're on a heart-lung machine. He said a neighbor came by. And the neighbor started out talking about all kinds of horror stories about the last time that he was in the hospital. And this gentleman said that he listened to this for about 2 hours. And he said, by the end of the 2 hours, he said, I was emotionally drained and I was ready to check out of the hospital. Well, that's obviously not the kind of friend you want. I mean, what you want is somebody whom you can sit and you can confide your worst fears in. You can let your hair down, so to speak. But you also want somebody who's upbeat and says, look, you may think that there's no hope in this situation, and you may think that your back is absolutely to the wall, but you're going to get through it. One Michigan youth that I interviewed went through a number of months of punishing chemotherapy. And I said to her after she got through on the other side, how'd you make it? And she said, well, I had a good friend. And whenever I had chemotherapy, my friend was there. I said, what did your friend say to you as you were going through that? She says, oftentimes she didn't say anything. It was that she was there. And she said, it really was due to that friend, support and encouragement, that got me through it. So I'd say, if you want to start at the starting point in getting through a tragedy, is you need to have a good friend, somebody who's going to believe in you. It seems to me that the second characteristic of survivors, and I learned this again and again as I talked to the 115 people, was that those who survived came to a point in their recovery where they believed that they had not lost everything. Now, that's a hard concept. And when you're going through really difficult times, and I've had people say, I have lost everything. And that's particularly true if you've lost a spouse or you've lost a child. I've lost everything. Not too long ago, I had an executive tell me when he lost his job that the thing that he thought about was that he had lost his life, because his life really was his work. And I think the second characteristic, though, of those people who were able to survive, and an important one, is that no matter what you're going through, you have not lost everything. I visited with a father who lost his 17-year-old child with cancer, and he told me about how long it took him to get over it. And I said, when was the point that you started to think that you were going to make it? And he said, the starting point that I thought I was going to recover was one day, he said, I was just thinking about my son. And it dawned on me that it was better to have had 17 good years with my son, Jeff, than not to have any of them at all. And he said, when I started to look at it that way, he said, I realized I hadn't lost everything. I had 17 good years. The gentleman I just mentioned who lost his job, he was an executive with a big company. And he said to me, he said, you know, I used to be the one that always fired people. I never thought I was going to get fired. I was the one that was laying people off. And he said, one day I came to work, and he says, my own boss called me in the office, and he says, you've been good to this company, but we're in financial difficulty, and you're laid off. And he had to take his stuff out of his desk that day and take it home. And he said, as he was going home, he knew his wife was going to be at home when he got there. And he said, the one thing I didn't want to do was cry. He says, I got into the house, and I saw my wife, and he said, I just broke down and cried. And I told her what had happened. And then she said, I want you to do something. She said, I want you to get out of the house for about an hour. She says, go over to the shopping mall, take a walk, just get out of the house for an hour, and then come back. And then when he got back, she had fixed a marvelous dinner. And they talked about what it meant to lose a job and how shattering it was. And then she took out a piece of paper, and on the left-hand side of the paper, they wrote down all that they had going for themselves. They loved one another. They had a little bit of savings in the savings account. She was a secretary. She thought she could go back to work. And he had a lot of friends in the community. And then on the right-hand side of the page, they wrote down the things that they had lost. And then he said, he took that piece of paper. He said he put it up in the study. And he said, when I looked at the two columns, he said, I saw how many things were on the left-hand side, the things that I still had going for me. And he said, when I saw that, he said, it wasn't that the things on the right-hand side weren't important, because I had lost a lot through this. But he said, the left-hand side, it just stuck out, that I had not lost everything. And so, no matter how difficult the experience right now may be for you, you got to remember, you have not lost everything. There was an interesting study in the New England Journal of Medicine not too long ago, in which they went and interviewed people who had gotten a very bad diagnosis from their physician. And what the researchers said is that they were amazed at the good mental health of the people that they interviewed. Now, it's not to say, they said, that they weren't depressed and that they didn't go through their, you know, their doubts and their worries and their concerns, but they said that they were impressed by how strong those people were, and that they were not emotional wrecks. And so there is within the human spirit a definite sense of hope that I'm going to overcome this. In 1981, a tornado went ripping right through by my house. It just barely missed the house. And as soon as the tornado went through, I went to see how my neighbors were. And I was amazed as I walked just 5 or 10 or 15 minutes after the tornado went through. They were out on their rooftops, and they were sweeping the shingles off. They had their power saws out. And in effect, they were saying, you know, this tornado, as serious as it is, it's not going to wreck us. And that's what you tend to find. You tend to find that once a tragedy hits, obviously, you go through some very, very difficult times. But within the human spirit, there is really a great sense of optimism. But it is all contingent upon the fact that you have not lost everything. And you understand that. And you recognize it.
Robert Veninga lost a close friend and began to wonder how other people survived tragedy. He asked the question to 115 people who had suffered tragedy and survived.
One of the things I was interested in talking to the 115 people is what really is the role of faith in the whole healing process. And of course it varied, because I had people in the study who were agnostics and people who were religious fundamentalists and people who were religious liberals, if you please. And so it really varied. But when we talk about the human spirit, what I did find is that those individuals who had a faith, no matter how they may happen to interpret it, did in fact get through their tragedy in better shape than those who didn't. Now, I wanted to probe and find out what that really was all about. And what I tended to find was that those individuals who professed a faith, they tended to belong to a synagogue or a church parish. And so what they had going for them is they had, first of all, a support system. And going back to what we talked about earlier about the importance of friends, they had a built-in social support system. And so sometimes people will say to me, well, just how is it that faith helps us in these experiences? Well, to begin with, most people are connected with a religious community of one type. And so when that takes place, all of a sudden there are people there that care about you. Now, in truth, it varies from one congregation, church, to another as to how long that caring goes on. And I talked to people who belonged to churches who said, well, you know, they were really great the first 2 weeks, and then they just kind of forgot me. You know, I don't know what ever happened. But then I met other people who belonged to congregations who said, you know, they were with me not only the first week, they were with me the first month, and they were with me the first year. And sometimes I talk to pastors and rabbis, and they say to me, you know, what is it that we need to do in our churches and synagogues to help people? I say, don't forget about them 6 months later. Don't forget about them 6 months later, because oftentimes that's when they really need the help. And so what you tend to find when we talk about faith, you tend to find that they're connected with a community, and I think that's terribly important. And I think it's one of the reasons that people who profess a faith and who really do belong to a synagogue or a church tend to survive things oftentimes better than those who do not have similar kind of connections. But I think it's deeper than that. And of course, faith is a very individualistic perspective. But by and large, I did find that people who did believe in God, by and large, were individuals who took one day at a time, who could wake up in the morning and say, whether they were in a cancer ward or wherever they happened to be, they could really turn that day over to a power that was greater than themselves. And they could, in fact, say, I don't know what's going to happen today. I don't know what the doctor is going to say when he or she comes into my room. But I have faith to believe that I can get through this day. And that tended to be a very, very powerful a help in a very difficult time period. I don't want to imply that you have to belong to a whole community of people, such as a church or a synagogue, in order to survive. But I would want to suggest very firmly that there has got to be a community somewhere that you feel connected to. Now, you know, it might be the people at work. I happen to be blessed with having some really good colleagues at work. So that when I was going through my very difficult experience with the death of my friend, I had three people who every once in a while would just say to me, I think maybe you need to go out for lunch on this day. Or let's stop on the way home for a cup of coffee. As long as you've got that community, the chances are very good you are going to get through the whole grief cycle much quicker than if you did not have that community.
You've been listening to a remix version of SCAN, an electronic sweep of the horizon discovering God's activity in the world. We featured Robert Veninga, who lost a dear friend. SCAN is a production of Select Learning, a continuing education program of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.